Really have appreciated so much your kind attention the last few hours we've had together, and look forward to this period and also the question and answer period that will follow. After we get through with this particular class on exposing evolutionary hoaxes, if you need to take a break, you're welcome to, but I would like to just go into the question and answer period after that, and feel free to think of some questions that come to mind as we're talking about this particular lesson or some of the other lessons that we've already gone over. I want to show you several quotations and go through them very rapidly of individuals over the last 70 years or so who have been very emphatic about the general theory of evolution being factual. W.W. Howes wrote in 1944, "Evolution is a fact like digestion." Another gentleman wrote in 1952, "Evolution of the animal and plant world is considered, get this, by all those entitled to a judgment to be a fact for which no further proof is needed." I would contend that this is an extremely arrogant statement on a couple of grounds. Number one, I know a lot of scientists who are fully believe in the biblical account of creation and yet are sound scientists, and they are certainly entitled to their judgment, as we all are, and that it has not been proven as they allege. The first point to make about Darwin's theory is that it is no longer a theory, but a fact, wrote Julian Huxley in 1960. No serious scientist would deny the fact that evolution has occurred. These kinds of statements have been parroted many times in various classrooms around the world and in this country. I was talking to a young man from southern Alabama several years ago, and he said, "Eric, I went into a class one day, science class at Auburn University, very large class, beginning of the semester." He said, "I went in, walked in, and one of the first things the teacher said near the beginning of the semester was, 'Does anyone in here believe in God?' I said, 'You believe in God, stand up.'" And he said about seven people stood up of this very large class. Stood up. He was one of them. And the professor looked at him and said, "By the end of this semester, no one will stand up when I ask that question." He said, sure enough, at the end of the semester, he did ask the question again. And he was the only one who stood up at the end of that semester. I was telling that to a congregation in Montgomery several years later, and a young lady from that same university came up to me and said, "That exact same thing happened to me." I don't know if it was in the same class or not. Probably was. I want you to know, young people, that you will face, probably sometime in your life, you will face various friends or professors, teachers, who will say things something like this: "Everyone who's entitled to a judgment knows that evolution is a fact." Well, the fact is, you are entitled to a judgment. Now, you have the choice to believe the truth or to reject the truth, to accept what the Bible has to say about our origins and consider the very fact that it is perfectly consistent with everything that we see in nature, as we talked about last night, or you can accept the theory of evolution, which has not been proven as a fact. This is the theory that they are talking about, this general theory of evolution that we discussed last night. All reputable biologists have agreed that evolution of life on Earth is an established fact. Who are the reputable biologists? Well, those who, according to B.B. Vance and D.F. Miller in their 1961 book, it's those who have accepted evolution. But there are thousands of biologists, reputable biologists in the world today, who reject the general theory of evolution. No serious biologist today doubts the fact of evolution. That simply is a lie. That's an untrue statement. The fact of evolution is amply clear, wrote Jay Savage in 1965. Stephen Jay Gould wrote in 1980, "Evolution is a fact like apples falling out of trees." He wrote in 1999 in Time magazine, we quoted this last night, "Evolution is as well documented as any phenomenon in science, as strongly as the Earth's revolution around the sun, rather than vice versa. In this sense, you can call evolution a fact." Michael LePage wrote in 2008, "Evolution is as firmly established a scientific fact as the roundness of the Earth," supposedly. That's how factual it is that you, supposedly, evolved from ape-like creatures. Here's a cover of U.S. News and World Report a few years ago. Thomas Hayden wrote, "By now scientists say evolution is no longer just a theory. It is an everyday phenomenon, a fundamental fact of biology as real as hunger and as unavoidable as death." This has been considered so much a fact that when about 10 years ago, a school board in Cobb County, Georgia, when they decided they were going to put this sticker in the front of science textbooks that teaches evolution as a fact, they decided they were going to put this sticker in the front, and the sticker reads, "This textbook contains material on evolution." Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. So here is a school board in Cobb County, Georgia, that said, we're going to put this sticker in the front of science textbooks, similar to this one right here, and we're going to let young people know that evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. By the way, the origin of living things, according to the theory of evolution, came from non-life. And it has never been proven that in nature, life can come from non-life. There is the theory of spontaneous generation that has been around for years and years and years, but evolutionary scientists have admitted, I have several quotations of them, where they said, yes, spontaneous generation, we have no example of it ever happening. But according to their theory, it had to happen at one time if there is no God. So they believe it in something they've never seen. Well, here is a sticker that says, evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. Now, study this, what does it say? With an open mind, carefully, critically. Young people, I would contend that this is a very good sticker and a very good statement from the standpoint of everything in life we ought to consider carefully, with an open mind. I mean, when it comes to God's Word, we don't want to go to God's Word and say, this is what I believe already, I want to go to God's Word and confirm everything I already believe. That's not a biblical approach to study. The approach is, let's open up God's Word and see what God has to tell us about directing our lives here on this earth to heaven through His Son, Jesus Christ. We study it carefully, critically, and with an open mind. That's how we ought to approach everything. Probably wouldn't be surprising to you to find out that not long after this sticker was put in textbooks, a few months later, that the American Civil Liberties Union got involved, the ACLU, and they filed a lawsuit against the Cobb County School Board saying that this sticker was unconstitutional. No comment about, no information in this sticker about God, about the Bible, about Christianity, about creation, about Genesis 1. In April 2004, the federal judge overseeing this refused to dismiss the lawsuit because he said the disclaimer, quote, could have the effect of advancing religion. Again, there's no statement in there about religion, no statement about Christianity, no statement about God. He went on to say that while the disclaimer has no biblical reference, so they admit it, or he did, it encourages, now get this, young people, it encourages students to consider alternatives other than evolution. And here's the fact, they do not want you to consider that. You know, I'm all for, we homeschool our children. You may think that is so weird. I don't know. You may or may not think that. We homeschool our kids. You know what my kids are going to know very well by the time they graduate? They're going to know a lot about the theory of evolution. I can guarantee you. In fact, I was reading an article some time ago about young people who do not believe in evolution, who use creation-based textbooks. You may say, oh, they must be really dumb. Creation-based textbooks. And studies have shown, have proven, that on average, they scored higher on their science exams than people who are using evolutionary-based textbooks, because they know the theory of evolution and the truth of creation at the same time. They score higher on their tests, and people can't figure out what's going on. You see, what has happened, and I have there's an article on our website about that, by the way. What has happened over and over again, and to me, this judge's statement really says a lot about it, is a lot of people do not want you to think outside of the evolutionary box they are trying to put you in. You might start thinking of alternatives other than evolution, and you can't do that. That is forbidden. We won't allow that. Wait a minute. Wouldn't it be good to consider things with an open mind, carefully, and with an open mind, what is the other word they use? Critically. Yes, thank you. Critically. Somebody's listening here. Maybe I need to. Carefully, critically, with an open mind. That's how I hope you hear these lectures. Not taking everything, again, I say just because I say it, but thinking about it critically, carefully, examining it. This guy says, wait a minute, it encourages students to consider something other than evolution. Well, good. That's great. You know what? If evolution is true, what does it have to fear? That's the thing about the beautiful thing about Christianity, the beautiful thing about truth, is it has nothing to fear. You could ask me some question here in the question and answer period that honestly I don't know the answer to, because there's plenty of them I don't. Believe me, I have an 11-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 7-year-old, and I get a lot of questions from them I don't know the answers to. Some of the hardest questions we get at Apologetics Press are, "Dear Digger Doug, why did," and then fill in the blank. Digger Doug doesn't know all the answers to all those questions. But I know this, truth has nothing to fear. I don't know about you, but I'm a little suspicious of statements like this. You might consider something other than evolution. Well, young people, you should. You should, and as we go through this hour, I think you'll see why. The judge stated in 2005, due to the manner in which the sticker refers to evolution as a theory, the sticker also has the effect of undermining evolution education to the benefit of those Cobb County citizens who would prefer that students maintain their religious beliefs regarding the origin of life. He then went on to say, the sticker also has the effect of implicitly bolstering alternative religious theories of origin by suggesting that evolution is a problematic theory even in the field of science. By denigrating evolution, the school board appears, again, all this from that one little sticker. By denigrating evolution, saying it's a theory and not a fact regarding the origin of living things, the school board appears to be endorsing the well-known prevailing alternative theory, creationism or variations thereof, even though the sticker does not specifically reference any alternative theories. I believe that this is just a case study and a small example of what's going on and what has been going on in this culture war regarding atheism and theism and creation and evolution in our country for a number of years. And so it was declared unconstitutional. And from what I understand, later after an appeal, the Cobb County School Board wound up having to pay, I believe it was over $150,000 in various court costs. And now I think you see, if you didn't already, why there are so many school boards who just give in to these things and don't fight it. Because the taxpayers are having to pay the hundreds of thousands of dollars to fight these things in court when the ACLU and other people carry it or file these lawsuits and it has to go to court. A lot of people just say, we don't have the money, we're not going to fight it. I'm not saying I agree with that, but you can almost understand. If you don't have the money, you don't have the money to do everything maybe you would like to do. And the enemies of truth, of Christianity, of creation, they apparently know this very well. Well, let me show you some of the examples that you will find in textbooks as alleged proof of evolution or something that leads to evolution. Again, here is a book, I mentioned this earlier, a textbook that's been used in different places around the country on evolution. It's only a 100-page textbook, okay, probably used in a 9-week period, maybe 18 weeks, but probably 9. Only 100 pages. Now, I already thought it was kind of odd that in a 100-page textbook on evolution, they would have so much information and just pictures about dinosaurs. I mean, you would think in a 100-page textbook, that might be long to some of you it's not very long, on evolution, that they would put their very best evidence in here. Because that's not a whole lot of space, especially when so much of it is filled with pictures. And this is for middle schoolers, 6th through 8th graders. Well, let me go through just a few of the alleged proofs of evolution. One of those is the famous English peppered moth story that has been told now for several decades. Some of you, by the expressions on your faces, probably have seen this before. Here is the way the story is told in this particular textbook. Because the gray moths were almost the same color as the tree trunks on which they lived, they were invisible to the birds that hunted them for food. Now, as the story goes, before the Industrial Revolution took place, back over 100 years ago, that the trees were lighter in color, and so the lighter colored moss outnumbered the darker colored moss by 95%. Well, 95% lighter colored moss, 5% darker colored moss. And then after the Industrial Revolution took place and soot began to cover the trees and they darken and they became black, well, then the lighter colored moss were easier seen by the birds, and so they decreased in number, and so that the darker colored moths eventually made up about 95% of the population. And so the story here is that the gray moths were almost the same color before the Industrial Revolution as the tree trunks on which they lived. They were nearly invisible to the birds that hunted them for food. As more factories were built in the area, soot from chimneys blackened the tree trunks. The gray moss could now be seen against the tree trunks. The few surviving black moss, however, now blended in with the tree trunks. As a result, they survived. Here's a story. It takes up basically an entire page here in this textbook with the pictures and the text. Well, there are a few problems with this story. By the way, here's a 1978 textbook with this same basic story in it about the moss, the peppered moss that rests on tree trunks during the day. This was, from what I understand, first proposed by Dr. Kettlewell back in the 1950s. And by the way, there is a book that I would encourage all of you to get if you get a chance, called Icons of Evolution by Dr. Jonathan Wells. He's gone through these things very meticulously, documented a ton of these things about the false things or the unproven and the unproven things that are in science textbooks all over the world. And one of the ones he mentions is this one right here on the English peppered moth. And what we have known for a number of years now is, number one, that the moths do not even rest on tree trunks, the English peppered moths. At least, it's very, very, very abnormal for them to. In fact, studies, the people who have been looking at this critically, they said only two of these moths that they've seen on tree trunks in the last 40 years. The way that Dr. Kettlewell got them on there was he glued them on there. These pictures are not moths just in normal, just sitting out there attached to tree trunks. They either glued them or pinned them on there. Furthermore, Dr. Kettlewell's results have never been replicated, never been duplicated. And yet it's in the textbooks as this story, the same way this story has been told now for decades in the textbooks. So the way the story is told, it's inaccurate. It's been known to be this way for a number of years. In Jonathan Wells' book, Icons of Evolution, he tells about how he interviewed a Canadian textbook writer about this particular alleged proof being in books about evolution. So he interviewed this textbook writer and said, why is this in the textbooks? And here are direct quotations from this Canadian textbook writer, Bob Ritter, who is quoted in Jonathan Wells' books. He said, you have to look at the audience. How convoluted do you want to make it for the first-time learner? Translation: listen, we can't make this very complicated, young people, so we're going to dumb it down for you, and we're just going to make it very simple. So we're going to tell you about English peppered moss and a story that's not even true because it somehow really illustrates evolution somehow. He went on to say, the advantage of this example of natural selection is that it is extremely visual. Okay. And by the way, natural selection takes place all the time. There's nothing wrong with natural selection, selective adaptation. We see that a lot. If you see a cat outside and he's chasing a bird or he's creeping up on a bird and he kills the bird, guess what? Well, there's an example of natural selection. There is a bird that died and a cat that lived, a cat that got one more meal and a bird that will not have any more meals. Okay, so we see creatures who are animals who adapt to their environments. Human beings do the same thing. There's nothing wrong with natural selection or selective adaptation. Creationists have no problems with that. There's nothing there that contradicts what we read in Scripture. But somehow this is in a textbook on evolution is somehow proof of evolution, and it's not even true. And textbook writers say, well, yes, but it's a very visual example. Well, I don't care if it's visual. You shouldn't care either. If it's not true, it's not true. So use something else. Oh, here's another example. Another thought. If it's not true, but yeah, it's visual and you can understand it, but it's not true, why don't they just use something else in these textbooks? I mean, if there's all this evidence for it, just use something else. Why would they continue to use something that is not true? Bob Ritter went on to say, we want to get across the idea of selective adaptation. Later on, they, high school students, can look at the work critically. We just want to get this idea of natural selection across to you. You can find the truth about all this stuff later. You know, the fact is, this same story you'll find in a lot of college textbooks. And you'll find even well-meaning people teaching these things in their science classes who have never heard the other side of this story, never heard some of the information that you're hearing this morning. Because much of the time, most people don't learn the truth about this later. Okay, pause here just for a second. So the way the story is told in this particular textbook right here, and many others, is not even accurate. But what if it was accurate? What does it really do? Okay, we had an English peppered moth, a lighter colored moth, a darker colored moth, one increase, one decrease. How does that prove the general theory of evolution? My contention is it doesn't whatsoever. Because small changes happen all the time. We see small changes taking place. I woke up this morning and I looked in the mirror and I looked at my head. I thought, I know I didn't have that many gray hairs yesterday. That's just, the other day I was feeling a little better about myself. I thought, I don't see as many gray hairs on my head. And today I thought, I see more than I think I've ever seen before. Well, changes happen. Some of us have less hair. Some of us have more hair. Some of us are getting bigger. Some of us are getting smaller. My dad is 76 years old, and my mother contends that he is shrinking. She thinks he's lost an inch or two in the last 10 or 15 years. I don't know if he has or not. But do changes take place? Certainly changes take place. In fact, the word evolution in and of itself is not a bad word at all. The word evolution comes from, I understand, the Latin word evolvere, which means to unroll, to unfold, to change. But when most people refer to evolution, they're talking about the general theory of evolution. As we defined last night, showed on several slides, that goo to you kind of evolution. That amoeba to worm to fish to amphibian to reptile to mammals to you kind of evolution. And the fact is, there is no proof that that kind of what is called by some macroevolution has ever happened. Changes take place all the time. Microevolution takes place. Creationists have no problem with that. I mentioned a few minutes ago, I think, or maybe one of the last periods, how the dog we have at home is half Springer Spaniel, half Weenie Dog. Now, I had a niece that brought home a dog a few years ago called what was the name of that thing? It was half Maltese, half Poodle. Maltipoo. Thing looked like a rat with long hair. We have a lot of varieties of dogs today, do we not? I heard the other day if someone, a friend of my wife's, had a Chia Poo or something. Half Chihuahua, half Poodle, or half half Chihuahua, half Weenie Dog. Chee Weenie or something like that. I'd like to see that. She said it was a very cute dog. Well, a lot of varieties of dogs today. I ate at a steakhouse in Jasper, Alabama a few years ago called Brangus Steakhouse. Do you know that steakhouse logically could not have existed 150 years ago? You know why? Because, from what I understand, there were no Brangus cows 150 years ago. It wasn't until about 110, 20 years ago when they got the Brahman breed and the Angus breed together, and now we have Brangus. I'm thankful for that. I like Brangus Steakhouse. I don't know if it's still there or not. A lot of changes have taken place. But according to the law of biogenesis, and according to everything we see in nature, which is what the law of biogenesis is based on, dogs always give birth to dogs, never cats. You know, when I was a little kid, I had a lot of misconceptions when I was a kid. I thought a lot of things that were just wrong. One of those was I thought all dogs were male and I thought all dogs were female. I thought horses were male and cows were female. Well, cows, I guess, are female, but all cattle, I thought, was female. Had a lot of misconceptions. Didn't quite understand what was going on there, but in nature, what you always see are hippos that give birth to hippos, giraffes that give birth to giraffes. What we see is animals produce after their own kind, which is what the law of biogenesis says. Life in nature comes from life and that of its own kind. Changes take place, but changes, here is the big dividing line between creationists and evolutionists, is that creationists believes that changes have limits. Okay, changes have limits. We see that in everyday life all the time. For example, I like to run just a little bit. You probably can't tell, but I like to run a little. I don't run a whole lot. If my ankles that the doctor has told me have arthritis in them, if they're not hurting me too bad, I like to go out and run 2 or 3, 4 miles. If I told you that when I started running, I could run a mile in 9 minutes, could you believe that? Could you believe I could run a mile in 9 minutes? Yeah. Okay. Could you believe that I could run a mile in 8 minutes a few weeks later? Yes. Not too hard to believe. I think the fastest mile I ever ran when I was a junior or senior, I think I ran it in 5.5 minutes, which is not that fast, but fastest time I ever had, I think. Now, what if I told you that a few weeks ago I was feeling really good? My wife had cooked the best supper she'd ever cooked. Oh, man, it was steak. We'd grilled steak, baked potato, green beans, fried okra, all the works. And a couple of hours later, I was feeling better than I'd ever felt health-wise, and I ran outside, and I ran a mile in 3.2 seconds. That's what? It's ridiculous? It's good. Couldn't happen. Well, why not? Hey, I went from 9 minutes to 5.5 minutes. Why couldn't I do it in 3.2 seconds? Well, I'm sure there are technical scientific terminology to describe that. The way that a Okie from Muskogee says it is, change has limits. Listen, you could get my spring weenie together with any other kind of dog you want to, but you're always going to get a dog out of it. And for some people, that may be too simplistic, but here's what I know, is that change has limits. And so even if this story of the English peppered moth that's told in textbooks all over the world, even if it was true, and it's not true the way they tell it, even if it was true, it still doesn't do anything for the general theory of evolution, because everybody understands that change happens, but change has limits. By the way, let me mention this to you. Back in Cobb County, Georgia, I actually delivered a lecture about problems in textbooks soon after this lawsuit. And the gentleman who, along with the ACLU, filed the lawsuit there in Cobb County, Georgia, came to my lecture, ate lunch with me, and he said, after hearing the lecture, some of the same things you're hearing today, he said, "I agree with you. Those textbooks, they've got some serious errors in it. But you, along with the ACLU, are filing a lawsuit, have filed a lawsuit saying they can't put a sticker up there that says evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things." He said, "Yep." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because you Christians are only about trying to get error out of science books." I said, "I'm all for getting out all error out of every book. I want math books to be truthful. I want history books to be truthful. I want science books to be truthful." So you're saying if I teamed up with you and say, "Let's get error out of all textbooks," you'd do that? And he acted like he would. I don't understand that mentality. Sure, I want all the error out of science textbooks, but I want error out of history books and math books too. I don't want math books saying 2 plus 2 is 5. 2 plus 2 is 4. That's good. That's right. That's the truth. Let's put it that way. The fact is, in our day and time, the errors that are in science books, I believe, have been much more critical and have been shown many more times than other kinds of error. Here is another example of supposedly proof of evolution that has been found in textbooks for a number of years now. A number of years. This is a picture of Ernst Haeckel, who said the turning point in his thinking was after he read Charles Darwin's book, The Origin of Species, back in 1860. And Ernst Haeckel came up with the idea that is known as ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Big fancy terminology which basically says this. Basically says that animals, that humans and our alleged animal ancestors, that in utero or in their mothers or in the eggs that may be laid by various animals like the chicken, that we all go through the various evolutionary stages of our alleged forefathers. Okay? This goes back a number of years. He drew these things back in the late 1800s. I want to read to you from a textbook, this one, that was printed in 1994 and was used in Graves County, Kentucky and other areas of this country even into the 21st century after the year 2000-2001. Let me read to you just a little bit. Referring to this image, I don't know if you can see this image or not, in the top left-hand corner there, kind of similar to the one that you see on the screen. Now, page earlier says this, "As you can see, the embryos of a fish, chicken, rabbit, and human appear almost identical in their early stages." What does this mean? Similarities in the embryos of different organisms indicate that these organisms share. Here's what they say. These similarities show that different organisms, they indicate that these organisms share a common ancestor, not a common creator, like I believe, like the Bible teaches, but a common ancestor. That is, these organisms all share a common heritage. Here's the picture, here's the wording. "These similarities in the early stages of embryo development are further evidence that the living things have evolved, that living things have evolved from earlier living things, and that that many living things share a common ancestor. Still told in textbooks today. Now let me show you what's interesting. Those were his drawings of what the embryo supposedly looked like at these various stages and these various animals. Years later, when they actually had cameras that could take pictures of these animals and human embryos at these same stages, here are the differences in reality and in his images that he drew. I would say and contend that there is a lot of difference there. For many years, it has been known that this story, the way it's been told in textbooks, is totally wrong. Now, as I've done several times this weekend, I would like to show you what some evolutionists have had to say about this. One of the most famous evolutionists of last century, Dr. Stephen Jay Gould, in Natural History Magazine, wrote an article called Atrocious, in which he said Ernst Haeckel, the gentleman we were just talking about, Haeckel remains most famous today as the chief architect and propagandist for a famous argument that science disproved long ago, but that popular culture has never fully abandoned. In the same article, he said, "We should therefore not be surprised that Haeckel's drawings entered 19th century textbooks, but we do, I think, have the right to be both astonished and ashamed by the century of mindless recycling that has led to the persistence of these drawings in a large number, if not majority, of textbooks." This is what an evolutionist had to say. I'm not saying that he disagreed with everything that every evolutionist who's ever used this argument with, but he knows there are some serious problems with it. Sir Arthur Keith wrote back as far back as 1932. Freely admit this is a dated quote. But this was some 50 years nearly after Ernst Haeckel came up with this idea of the embryo retracing its evolutionary heritage inside of the mother for approximately 9 months. He said, "It was expected that the embryo would recapitulate or retrace the features of its ancestors from the lowest to highest forms in the animal kingdom." It was expected. "Now that the appearance of the embryo at all stages is known, the general feeling is one of disappointment." Why do you think they were disappointed? Because it doesn't prove what they had alleged for a number of years. See, here's what has happened. I've mentioned this already before, but I want to press this. What's happened is this is proof of evolution. And then what is found a few years later? Actually, it's not proof at all. But many people bought into evolution partly because of this, and it's still in textbooks, and many people are still buying into it, at least partly, because of misinformation such as this. The human embryo at no stage is anthropoid in appearance. The embryo of the mammal never resembles the worm, the fish, or the reptile. Embryology provides no support whatsoever for the evolutionary hypothesis. And yet it's still in the textbooks. And again, I would like to go and look at this from a little different angle for just a moment and think about this. Number one, the way it's been told for a number of years is inaccurate. But number two, I've got to go another step and just ask this. What if there were some similarities between the way different organisms looked in utero? I mean, let's say that at one point, the chicken in that egg, and boy, I love to eat chickens, and I love to eat eggs too, by the way. But let's just say, I'm sorry, I got distracted there for just a moment. Let's say that chicken embryo and the human embryo, at some stage, that they look similar. They don't, according to even evolutionists, but let's say they did. So what? What does that mean? My point is this. It no more proves evolution than it does creation. If God is the creator, could he have made a chicken embryo that looks similar to a human embryo at some point in the stage in their early existence? Sure he could have. That doesn't prove evolution. It doesn't prove creation. I wouldn't use it as proof for creation because they look similar. By the way, one of the other well-known proofs of evolution that is used in textbooks over and over again is found right there before this proof from embryology. It's this proof from homology. That is the idea that when you look around the world today, You see a lot of similarities in different animals and in humans. And so because there are similarities, then this proves that we all evolved from some common ancestor hundreds of millions of years ago. Are there some similarities between the hand of the human, the wing of the bat, the foot of the dog, or the leg of the dog, and the flipper of the whale? I mean, they don't look that similar, but sure, we'll say there are some similarities. But what does that prove? It does. You see, that's the story that evolutionists tell is, here are similarities, and thus, because there are similarities, this proves that we all came from a similar ancestor, or the same ancestor, have the same ancestor. I'm sorry, it doesn't prove that. That's the story that is told. But where is... Show me the line of evidence that says A plus B equals C. And here's... That's their story. And that's what they say is fact, as we've already noticed on a number of slides. Fact, 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 fact. Well, number one, there's a lot of phoniness about it. But number two, even if these things were accurate the way they describe them, it doesn't point to conclude, the conclusion is not forced, well, we must have evolved millions of years ago from a common ancestor. You know, one of the things that you'll hear a lot is humans and the DNA of apes are 96 to 99% similar. There's proof that we evolved from ape-like creatures. No, actually, it's not proof. That's... Might that be a true statement? May very well be. I don't know if it's 96%, 97, 95, 94. I don't know exactly what it is. I think it's changed over the last few years some. I have no problem believing that. Why? Well, because are apes living things? They are. Are humans living things? We are. Granted, we are made in the image of God, and they are not, according to Genesis chapter 1. Do apes drink water? Yep. Do we drink water? Do we have to have water to survive? Yes. Do they have to have food to survive? Do they eat food? Yes. Do we eat food? Do we eat many of the same foods? Yes. Do they live on the same terrain that we live on? I mean, sure, they live on grass and, you know, dirt and everything else. So we live in the same world. We need a lot of the same things. It's not surprising that there is a lot of genetic similarities there. But again, just like embryology or homology, just because there may be, and in regard to embryology, there's not near the similarities that they touted 100 years ago. That's still being touted in textbooks. But even if there are all of these similarities, what does it prove? It does not prove evolution. That's the story that they tell, and that has been told for a number of years. Did you know that scientists never would have imagined that we would have very many similarities with our DNA with sea sponges? We don't look anything like a sea sponge. I mean, you got SpongeBob SquarePants, and they kind of make him out to be something more than he is, I guess, you know. Don't know much about old SpongeBob, but scientists discovered a few years ago that the DNA of sea sponges and humans are similar 70% of the time. I don't know the exact phrase they use, something like 70% similarity between humans and sea sponges. There's a 75% similarity between us and the DNA of a nematode worm. Does that bother me? No. If that's the case, that's the case. But guess what? It doesn't prove that we came from nematode worms or that we came from sea sponges. And just because there are similarities in DNA with various other creatures here on this earth, that is the story that they tell. You know, I don't use this as proof for creation or proof for the existence of God, but I will elaborate on a point. That is, if you ask me, why do I think there are these similarities? I've already given you one reason. We drink water, we breathe air, we need... So obviously there are going to be lungs and esophaguses and trachea and, you know, different things, stomachs, intestines. But we have these similarities. Why would we have these similarities? Well, number one, we live on the same planet with all these other living things. But number two, it makes perfect sense to me that if God created man in His image, that He would have created a creation. And again, please understand, I'm not saying this proves creation. I'm saying to me it makes perfect sense. And it shows, I believe, points to a loving God, that He created a creation that's similar enough to you and me that the ones that are created in the image of God can actually experiment and perform tests on mice and rats and even monkeys, apes, to be able to experiment on them and not kill human life, but to use God's creation in making human life better. I'm thankful that we can experiment on pigs and rats and so forth, and that different drugs can... I don't think we ought to be unnecessarily harmful to animals, unnecessarily, but I believe that animals are here for humankind. Genesis 1 tells us that we are to subdue the earth, have dominion over the earth, and so forth. I mean, Jesus rode a donkey. Jesus ate fish. Jesus and the Bible, the righteous people in the Bible, you can see how they handled various animals throughout history, used them for clothing, offered sacrifices, ate them. I believe there are some good reasons why God would have created things similarly. Because if you can test a certain drug on an animal and it helps that animal, it may very well then help a human. And I would much rather some tests be done on animals than on humans. Let me show you another alleged proof of evolution, or at least that's been in textbooks on evolution for a number of years. The older generation, my generation and older, maybe those of you who are 40 or 50 or 60, may remember images like this or illustrations like this in textbooks of alleged proof of evolution that came from fossils of horses. As recently as 2002, the journal Scientific American said, a sequence of fossils spans the evolution of modern horses from the tiny Eohippus, the alleged great-great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaddy and so forth of the modern-day horse, known as equus. Well, interestingly, Dr. George Gaylord Simpson said in 1953, that's a long time ago, he knew then, wait a minute, there's some serious problems here. He said the uniform continuous transformation of Hyracotherium, another name for Eohippus, into equus, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, never happened in nature. And you might say, well, Eric, maybe there have been a lot of fossils that have been found since then. Well, notice that in 2000, in the same article I mentioned a few minutes ago by Dr. Stephen Jay Gould, he said, once ensconced in textbooks, misinformation, that's a key word there, misinformation becomes cocooned and effectively permanent. Paid by your tax dollars, by the way. Because, as stated above, textbooks copy from previous texts. I have written two essays on this lamentable practice, one on the amusingly perennial description of the Eohippus or Don Horse as the size of a fox terrier, even though most authors, including yours truly, have no idea of the dimensions or appearance of this breed. And yet, for a number of years, this has been in textbooks as proof somehow of evolution. Look at how the horses have evolved over millions of years. It's still been mentioned in National Geographic as recently as 2004, talking about the horse-like creature known as Hyracotherium. As far back as 1954, going back again, as far back as 1954, as recently as 2000, evolutionists themselves have known there's some serious problem with this so-called proof of evolution. He said the family tree of the horse is beautiful and continuous only in the textbooks. In the reality provided by the results of research, it is put together from three parts, of which only the last can be described as including horses. The forms of the first part are just as much horses as present-day daemons or dogs or horses. The construction of the horse is, therefore, a very artificial one, since it is put together from non-equivalent parts and cannot, therefore, be continuous. I know that's a lot of words for you, but basically what he and these others have said is this. You know, in the textbooks, they have all of these, well, here's the horse, and here's the great-great-great-granddaddy of that horse, and here's the horse, you know, before that millions of years ago, and here's the ancestor of that horse, and et cetera, et cetera. Just ask this question. How do they know that this animal evolved into that animal? How do evolutionists know that? They don't. That is the story they tell based upon a few fossils that they find here and there. And that's the story that they tell. By the way, in most textbooks these days, it appears to me, they no longer talk much about horse evolution. Not that much. It's been replaced with a lot of other things like camel evolution. In fact, in this particular textbook right here, you'll see on page 51, about two-thirds to three-fourths of this page is a big illustration of camels and their alleged ancestors. Where's the proof? Where is the proof? Well, let me read it for you. Here's the proof. At least what they give in this middle school textbook. Living things have evolved or changed over time. Again, I have no problem believing that things have changed over time. But they're talking about the general theory of evolution, which is over many hundreds of millions of years, these animals changed into a totally different kind of animal. They say the diagram shows the fossil record of the past 65 million years in the evolution of the camel. And the great-great-great-great-granddaddy here at the bottom of this one doesn't really look quite like that one. Here it looks more like a dog. Question is, where's the proof of this? It's simply their interpretation of what some of the fossils they have for some of the fossils in the fossil record. Let me turn. I have this one on the screen behind me there. Turn to page near the end of this book on page 78 regarding alleged human evolution. Page 78, we read, there is no doubt among scientists that humans evolved from common ancestors they share with other living primates. Scientists also know that the human species evolved in Africa and then spread around the earth. You know, one of the difficult things in being a public teacher, I mean a preacher, those of you who've ever delivered a lesson know this. You know, sometimes when you speak for several minutes or hours, sometimes you get tongue-tangled and you might say things you didn't really mean to say it quite that way and you have to reword it later or whatever. But I'm amazed in textbooks like this how over and over and over again. I mean, I want to give people the benefit of the doubt when I can. I think that's a good Christian thing to do. But what I've seen over and over and over again are statements like this that are just wrong, that are just lies, that are false on a few different levels. And one of those is this. There is no doubt among scientists. That is a lie. That is a huge lie. That there is no doubt among scientists that humans evolved from common ancestors they share with other living primates. That's a lie. There is a ton of doubt among scientists. Now, you can reword this to say, among atheistic evolutionary scientists, there is no doubt. There would be doubt among some theistic evolutionists about some of these things. And so, who are they calling scientists? Those that believe in evolution. Let me tell you something. I know some good operational scientists. I mean scientists who are in the field, who are experimenting on a regular basis, who are doing research, who are doing real research, who are doing research on cancer, who are doing research in a variety of other fields. They're solid scientists who do not believe that we evolved from apes. And yet what you are fed and have been, what people have been fed in this country and around the world, a steady diet of for a number of years is you evolved from ape-like creatures. I can only think it's by the grace of God that more people do not believe the garbage that you read in textbooks like this. Let me see how much time I have left. It's 1:30. Before we get into the question and answer period, let me just show you this one other thing. Just an example of the so-called proof of human evolution. Here's the cover of Time magazine a few years ago, How Apes Became Human. I mean, right here on the cover of Time magazine, here is an illustration of one of our alleged great-great-great-so-forth grandparents. Here he is, Ardipithecus Romidus Kadaba. Are you convinced that this is one of our... I mean, here it is, right here on the cover of Time magazine. You're told this is how apes became human. You open up and you have a big two-page layout. Ardipithecus Romidus Kadaba. There he is. Has it convinced you yet? The discovery of a handful of bones in Ethiopia brings scientists tantalizingly close to the time, 6 million years ago, when our most ancient ancestors took their first upright steps. A look at the juncture when chimps and man went their separate evolutionary ways. In all, the team eventually found 11 specimens, that is fossil specimens, from at least 5 different individuals in a cluster of sites. So where is the proof for Ardipithecus Romidus Kadaba being our great-great-great-great ancestor? Where's the proof? They found, according to this article, 11 fossil specimens from 5 different individuals in a cluster of sites. And so from a few fossil specimens, they had an illustrator draw this and this. Put it on the cover of Time magazine. Take a guess how many fossil specimens they had of the head of this creature to give direction to an illustrator to illustrate that. One. A piece of the right mandible, I believe it was, right or left mandible. You know, if I gave you a fossil, even though you don't have the training that a lot of people have who study these things and illustrate these things, I have my doubts whether you could draw, or anyone could draw, a very accurate picture of what the entire head of that creature looked like. I mean, sometimes I'm still, you know, skeptical about what some of the dinosaurs look like, because when you go to the Fernbank Museum of Natural History and you look at this 110-foot-long Argentinosaurus, what you find out later is they only excavated 10% of it. So they're having to guess a lot, about 90% of the time, because they only they do know he was a really big character. Big dinosaur. I mean, he had one backbone that was something like 5 feet high, one vertebra. I mean, he was a big boy. So they know that. A lot of guesswork. I freely understand that. One piece, one small piece of the entire head of this creature, and they decide to illustrate him and put him on the cover of Time magazine. You talk about a lot of fluff and not a lot of meat. This toe bone proves the creature walked on two legs. They found the toe bone. I don't know if you know this or not, but approximately one-fourth of all of the bones in your body are in your feet. I think there's about 26 bones in each foot, unless you got an extra bone or two there. You know, some people may have a little extra little crook or something going on. Anyway, so one toe bone, supposedly, proves the creature walked on two legs. Not only is it, this toe bone, separated in time, they said in the article, by several hundred thousand years, but it was also found some 10 miles away from the rest. I'm sorry, but you know, when I look at some of this, just like last night, I was reading that article about the Big Bang. You know, what put the bang in the Big Bang? Well, inflation did. But then as you continue to read in that article, actually, inflation, we don't have any proof it ever happened. We don't know why it would have happened. We're still as confused as ever about the whole matter. What you see a lot of times in regard to the general theory of evolution is big, grandiose claims. Where's the evidence? Well, it's, you know, this is kind of what we think is right. In a current science magazine, this is a reader that's used in science classes. You might get this in your science class occasionally. I know a few years ago, a lot of science classes were getting this, given out to millions of students around the country. Could apes rule? It was kind of, they were playing off of the Planet of the Apes movie. They had a story about Ardipithecus rhombatus cadaver right here on page 12. Earliest human ancestor. By the way, we contacted, if I remember correctly, Time magazine a few years ago to see if we could use this illustration. If I remember correctly, they wouldn't let us use it. Of course, they would know that we're trying to show the flaws in this reasoning. Here are some of the things that they were teaching middle school students about Ardipithecus. The bones and teeth of a newfound species that lived in the forest of Africa 5.8 million years ago could be the remains of the oldest human ancestor ever found. I appreciate the fact that they put could in there. I mean, I think still that is a ridiculous statement, but it's much better than these were remains of a human ancestor. They went on to say this, though. Until now, the oldest known human ancestor was Ardipithecus rhombatus, which lived about 4.4 million years ago in Africa. Fossils of the ancestor were found in Ethiopia in the 1990s. The newly discovered species carries the name Ardipithecus rhombatus cadaba. Its discovery moves paleontologists closer to the time when supposedly humans and apes went their separate ways. But now notice and listen to this, what they say. Working from the bones and teeth of cadaba, the scientists and the scientific illustrators that they use sketched a portrait of a creature that stood 1.2 meters tall. 4 feet, the height of a modern chimpanzee. Cadaba's brain was the size of a chimp's stew, and its body was similarly proportioned. It was the height of a chimp. Its body was proportioned like a chimp. Its brain was the size of the chimp. Oh, but here we go. Unlike chimps, however, Cadaba was probably bipedal. It walked upright much of the time. Well, how do they know that? Because they found a toe bone. Toe bone separated 10 miles away from the rest. And even though it is the height of a chimp, even though it has a brain the size of a chimp, even though his body is proportioned like a chimp, they found a toe bone 10 miles away from the rest, separated in time by hundreds of thousands of years. But it proves this creature that has the height of a chimp, that has the brain the size of a chimp, and that is similarly proportioned as a chimp, is probably one of our ancestors who walked upright millions of years ago. A few million years ago. If you detect some agitation on my part, I freely admit it. I get a little bit worked up about this, but I get aggravated by it. Because I've seen young people, I've been studying this and looking at this and writing on these things and talking about these things for 11 years now. And I've seen it over and over and over. I've seen young people, just like some of you right here, who have decided, number one, young people who decided that they weren't really going to listen to what the Bible has to say about these things. They weren't going to listen to what maybe other scientists have to say about these things who are creationists and have been deluded into thinking that atheistic evolution must be true. I cannot tell you how many stories in the last 11 years of my life that I've heard of an individual growing up in a Christian home saying, I'm just rejecting all of what I've heard my entire life as nonsense. And I'm going to accept the kinds of things that you see here. I was talking to a preacher up in Virginia I guess it was a few years ago now. He was telling me about a young man, described him as a rock-solid Christian, went away to a university. It's not impossible, young people, to remain faithful. You can remain faithful. You can be strong. You can obey the truth and continue to walk in the light. This young man sat in a class of a skeptic. Didn't take him long to go back home, tell his preacher, I no longer believe that book. That book is full of nonsense. It doesn't have to happen to you. And I hope and pray it doesn't. I do hope that you will be open-minded to truth and that you will hear the truth, that you will learn the truth, and that you will obey the truth. And that you, for your own, will decide for yourself who and what you are going to be committed to in this life. Oh, I want you to be a faithful Christian who accepts the Bible for what it says. But the fact of the matter is, you have to believe that because you know it is what is right and what is good.